Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 337 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyler, your host, as usual. And today my guest is Owen McGran. Now, Owen is a friend of mine outside of Pittsburgh, a fellow solo practitioner, small firm owner. In fact, as you're going to hear, he owns two small firms and fellow guitarist. So we spent a lot of time talking about guitars before the interview, a little bit during the interview. And as I mentioned, I feel like the interview was something of a case of me interviewing myself, because Owen and I, our practices and our approach to them align a lot. So we're very similar in how we view the practice of law and how it relates to our clients. So I think that, you know, we spend way too much time yakking about things that we understand and that are important for us. But I think we'll shed some light on a couple of those issues for those of you who are still struggling with trying to understand where that fits in your practice. So without any further delay, here is my friend, Owen McGran. Owen McGran, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It's a delight to have you with us today, Owen. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Sure. So my name is Owen. I am a startup attorney, and I work in estate planning as well. I'm a masochist in that I own two law firms. And
it does sound like a bit masochistic.
You know, it sounded like a great idea when I came up with it. So
our good friend Sam Malay in Los Angeles, he owns seven law firms.
Well, so you know, way to go, Sam, to catch. Yes, Sam is ahead of me, and he's special in that regard. So I think two will suffice, at least for the foreseeable time being.
Now, have you split them along practice area lines, or?
Yeah, so I started my first firm, McGran Law, very cleverly named, about 4 years ago after spending roughly eight or nine years in big law.
Okay.
And initially there, I focused on working with small businesses, and doing so raised a bunch of issues with succession planning for family-owned businesses, and that got me into estate planning, and that took on a life of its own. And over the summer, I started speaking with Wendy Witt, who is another attorney here in Pittsburgh. And she said, hey, it might be fun if we opened our own firm. And I said, yeah, I think that'd be great. So I split off my estates practice into a new firm with Wendy called Purely Estates Law Group. And, you know, here we go.
And so when did you split off with Wendy and start doing that?
So we started talking about it in June. We had a soft launch last month, and we are now taking customers. So, you know, we are brand new. We are in the point that is my favorite part of a firm, which is you're starting out and you get to break things and see what works.
Well, yeah. And I will say that one of the challenges, not getting drowned by the amount of things that seem to break.
Well, right.
In the beginning. But you've had the benefit of having the previous firm in place
for a while. It's been really interesting looking back at when I started my first firm and the things that I was thinking about versus what I'm thinking about now. And I look back and it's like, wow, you know, I learned a lot, at least, because, you know, the things I was concerned about then, you know, what colors are the firm's colors going to be and what's the logo? It's like that shit does not matter at all.
No.
And You know,
eventually it does, but not in the very beginning.
No, at the very beginning, you know, the concern is what's the business model, right? And one of the things that, you know, 8 years, 9 years in big law did not prepare me for, and I think that a lot of lawyers in general have still to make this realization, is that your law firm is a business, right? It's it's not just you practicing law. You're running a business, right? And, you know, as I started getting into running my firm, I realized that I liked running businesses a lot more than I liked practicing law, it turned out.
And there's so, a lot of that going around in the legal community.
Yeah. You know, and once we get past our, you know, the prejudices that we have been, you know, instilled with in law school, you know, looking down on business as somehow, you know, impure or, you know,
antithetical to the practice of law.
Right. You know, it's like somehow you have to, you know, belittle yourself or you're lower yourself to think about business. You know, that's all nonsense. And, you know, it's no wonder that so many lawyers are unhappy in their business because they don't treat it as such.
Or unsuccessful.
Unsuccessful too, right.
Yeah, which leads to that unhappiness. You know, and a lot of times, I mean, you have to look no further than, you know, what the rules were and the feelings were about advertising.
Right.
And marketing a law practice. And somehow that was looked down upon as being unbecoming of an attorney. Well, and yet, you know, how do you expect to survive unless you market your business?
It is still the case that
in many ways,
it is still the case that attorneys, if you want to make them blush, you just say the word sales, you know, as if, you know, we weren't salespeople all the time in almost every aspect of our lives. You know, we have to come up with euphemisms for it. You know, well, we do business development.
You took the words right out of my mouth. You took the words right out of my mouth. You know, you can't talk about sales to an attorney, but boy, they'll spend a lot of time and a lot of money trying to learn about business development.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah. Or client acquisition.
Right.
We call it client acquisition.
Right. You know, and then at some point you just want to say, why don't we just talk about the thing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the 800-pound elephant in the room is selling your practice.
Right. And there's nothing wrong with it. You know, as soon as you realize that what sales is seeing that somebody else has a need for something and that you're able to help them. All you're doing is your moral imperative saying, hey, I can help you.
Indeed. And I think also that thinking is something that attorneys come by with some challenge. Mm-hmm. Not wired, or they're not trained or taught to look at it from the perspective of the client has a problem. What's their problem, and how does what I do serve to help solve it?
Right.
And most attorneys look at it from, I want to do estate planning. How do I get more people to be interested in estate planning? And it's just a turning that, it's, you know, telescope around and looking at it from the other end.
Right, right.
Instead of looking at it from the client's perspective, you're looking at it from the attorney's perspective. And that almost never works. Sometimes it does, but almost never.
No, I mean, it misses the point, you know, and so many of us, you know, when we are thinking about this kind of thing, you know, we think about, okay, what can we provide to them? And it's usually a document, or, you know, an estate plan is going to have a will, you know, a financial power of attorney, a healthcare power of attorney, a living will, maybe a trust. We think about it in terms of the documents, whereas, you know, if we sat down with them and just asked about their lives and wanted to figure out what it is that they wanted to happen, what we're selling them is a transformation, not documents. Right.
Yeah.
Right now, you're not protecting your family, but you want to. Let's get you there.
Yeah. In fact, I just got an email this morning from a past client, and I'm actually looking at it right now. I'm just going to quote it. So I want to thank you again for your assistance you gave us with our estate planning. We have been able to move forward with our other life plans, largely as a result of having completed that task.
Right.
So that doesn't say anything about you know, thank you for the documents you helped craft.
Right.
You know, what you realize there is that they as a couple had some life plans, and they're all intertwined as we get a little older, and helping them to sort out where to start and how to get something that's fundamentally done as their estate plan is enormously helpful to them.
Right.
Right. And it gives them ease of mind. So what you're really selling there is peace of mind.
That's right. You know, and this serves, you know, a couple of different purposes. One, just the customer relations, right? When you realize that there's a person on the other side who has wants, needs, desires, you know, people they care about, people that love them, you're dealing with somebody on a level that they already understand, right? You can talk to them in a language that they know and that they respond to. The second level is a business level, which is if you are getting them to think about what you're doing with and for them on that level, they understand the value of what you're providing for them, right? In a way that if you say, here are the documents I'm going to give you, it's going to be $4,500. They're going to say, for what? Like 100 pages of documents? But if you put it in terms of that first bit that we're talking about in enabling their lives, right? Enabling them to move forward, to do things that they've really cared about for their entire lives and have yet been able to do, all of a sudden they understand the value. Right. And it's easier to have those pricing conversations because they will understand what it is that you're helping them do.
Yeah. The corollary approach. Is that the right way to say that? The related approach is to help them or to make sure you're addressing some pain point they have.
Right. Right.
So if, again, putting it in estate planning terms, if they've had a family member who's passed who either had a really bad estate plan or no estate plan at all, oftentimes that's the triggering event that brings them to the door. Not always, but oftentimes. And so if you can position your marketing to say, you know, you don't want that for your family. You don't want to burden your family with those kinds of difficulties. We can help you have the peace of mind of knowing that you've plan this all out.
It's act of love.
Two sides of the same coin.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the attorneys get so caught up in the minutiae of what we do on a daily basis that we stop seeing it in terms of the human impacts that we have on people.
Yeah.
And if we were able to better, you know, situate our own heads in what we're doing, I think, one, we'd be a lot happier because we understand that we are, in fact, changing people's lives, right? We're not just sitting down and billing time. We are, in fact, changing people's lives.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So I want to circle back to something you said earlier about, you know, the decisions you made when you first started your solo practice and now how that's influenced some of the decision making that you're doing with the second firm that you've developed. So I know I've told this story before. When I went solo, I wanted this physical space, and I really wanted a wet bar in my office because I had these grand and glorious ideas that, you know, like on LA Law on TV, that at the end of the day, the wet bar would be open and my colleagues would have this great time, happy hour in the office. And, you know, I spent more money and time worrying about that than really trying to figure out, how I was going to run a law practice. So tell me a little bit about, you had this perfect, perfect scenario here. We had an opportunity to make some mistakes in the beginning and an opportunity to correct them on the second go around. So what are some of the things that you did differently?
So, you know, the most fundamental thing is when I started my first firm, I carried over with me from Big Law an hourly billing model.
Oh, yeah.
And if there's been a more pernicious influence on the practice of law than the billable hour, I would like to hear what it is, because I think the billable hour has ruined people's lives. you know, I could
well, rant certainly for, you were a slave to that in big law. Assuming that as a big law associate,
right?
That is the topic number one, two, and three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I could rant about the billable hour for hours, and if you look at my LinkedIn page, you will see that I've been doing so for months. You know, it's, you know, one of the things that I had to do in order to get to a place where I could be happy practicing law was to get away from the billable hour. And in the process of doing that, I realized that it wasn't only, you know, the billable hour wasn't only bad for the attorneys in the model, in the business model, it was bad for clients too. In that, you know, time is not a unit of value, right? Time is a unit of time. Determining what something is worth and pricing based on an hour, you know, Ronald Baker, you know, basically says it's like trying to determine, you know, the weight of something by pulling out a thermometer, right? They're different units. They don't make sense. So you practice in estate planning.
I did.
There are certain things.
I will say, though, formerly when I did family law, I was using the hourly model.
Sure, sure. When you meet with potential customers in that initial, you know, hour and a half, however you set it up, consultation, you can probably figure out within the first 10 minutes of them talking about the actual elements of what you need to know to put together a plan, how you can really benefit them, right? Because you've done it for a long time and you understand how it works, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that law school does teach you. It's issue spotting and being able to quickly assess what the potential client needs,
right?
And how you can best serve them.
And if you've got a systematized practice and you've got, you know, the basic documents that you'll be able to put together, you can probably save certain families tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes in that first 15 minutes and then putting together the document, maybe another hour, right?
Sure.
Is it a proper unit of value to say, okay, I charge $300 an hour, so that'll be what, $325 for all of that value that you're providing to them, right? There's a misalignment there. It doesn't work. You know, and what we find is that, you know, attorneys working in the billable hour recognize that that's not really fair. So they will, you know, somehow
put more hours into the job.
Right, right. But, you know, if that's the case, if you have to manipulate the hours, the model doesn't work.
Right.
So let's do the hard work up front, figure out what the value is, what it's worth to a client, and price it as such, as opposed to retroactively billing for work. You know, and I think that when you get into the idea of value pricing, you understand what you're doing a lot better. Your clients are going to understand what you're doing a lot better, and you're both going to be happier. So, you know, that's the most fundamental difference between when I started my first firm and this firm.
So did you ultimately then convert the billing approach in your first firm to something other than?
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, so the first firm, what remains in the first firm is I work in the startup area. So I work with startups from the most basic, you know, okay, let's form your LLC all the way up through. So there's a middle level where I do a subscription sort of fractional general counsel thing.
Sure.
And then for a select group, I will take equity in a company and partner with them, sit on the board, right, you know, and do all that kind of stuff. Under none of those models do I bill hourly.
Right.
You know, and it's worked out tremendously well for me.
If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients. You know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast.
As
As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I have been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com. I just had a conversation with a family law attorney last week who was telling me how she was switching over to a fixed price model based on deliverables in the family law sphere or space. And one of the things that really helped is that she had a database of hourly matters that had been completed, and she could go back and say, all right, how many hours on average did we expend to get to the first mediation? And so they had a lot of data to base their pricing reevaluation on when they decided to go to a, you know, flat fee for certain deliverables. Did you kind of take the same approach?
I did it first.
Or was it just intuitive based on...
So I did that at first. The model that your colleague just outlined, I think, is a definite step forward from a normal billable hour model.
Yeah.
I think it's also still a disguised hourly rate, right? Where you're saying... Because it's still based on this presumption that the value of something is the amount of time it takes you to do something.
Right.
And, you know, don't get me wrong. I think that what she's doing is
it's absolutely
right. It's a necessary point. It's really difficult psychologically to lose the billable hour, right? Because, you know, after 8-9 years in big law, you know, to this day, after a period of time, you know, I can say, okay, that was about a 0.3. Right.
Yeah.
And I'll look at the, and it had been 18 minutes. Right.
Internal clock is working.
Right. Right. I mean, it literally rewires your brain. But, and I'm about to say something that will probably piss off a lot of attorneys.
Okay.
I first heard this. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with Y Combinator. They are a VC firm. Right. They have something called Startup School. And one of the speakers at Startup School had a talk on pricing. And what he said was, you know, the way that you know that you've got your pricing priced properly is if your ideal clients bitch about the price but still pay it. Because that's that threshold where they've determined the value of what it is. It's worth it, but it's right at that level where, you know, they're starting to feel it a little bit. And the difficult part of that for what we do is that becomes a very individual pricing model, right? It's not just a flat fee in terms of, okay, if it's going to be a will-based estate plan for a couple, it starts at this price, right? And so a lot of what I've done is I've determined for different areas of or different types of work, whether it's in estate planning or in the startup area, there's a minimum price that I find is valuable to me, valuable enough to me to do the work for, right? So I'll set a floor for what I will do. And if I'm talking with somebody and I realize that it is incredibly valuable to that customer, I will price it according to the value that they assign to it, as opposed to what I think it's worth. That might mean that two different customers who get roughly the same thing are going to pay wildly different prices.
Yeah.
And that makes a lot of attorneys uncomfortable.
Yeah, but you know, that's done in a lot of practice
it is.
Areas. I mean, I've seen it particularly in criminal defense. And in a way, it's somewhat necessary.
That's right.
You can say for this level of offense, you know, I typically charge X, which is the floor, if you will. But if in understanding the particulars of a defendant's or an alleged defendant's life situation and maybe that of their families, you may recognize that that level of work has much more value to them than your first client.
That's right.
And I see defense attorneys charge X plus Y for this client. Same thing. So I don't think that's altogether universally frowned upon.
I agree. You know, and there are certain areas where, you know, if there are certain attorneys who, you know, might not work a whole lot, but make millions of dollars a year because, you know, if you're a public company and somebody is threatening to hostilely, you know, take you over, right? If you call this attorney, they'll find you a white knight in 8 hours, you know, 16 hours, right? And you fend off the hostile takeover. That attorney is going to charge you $10, $15, $20 million for that 8 hours of work, right? But it's going to be worth it to you, right? Yeah. You don't lose the company. You know,
well, it reminds me of that old joke, and I forget what the setup is, but basically the client says, you're going to charge me $1 million for 8 hours worth of work?
Right.
You only made 3 phone calls. Mm-hmm. And the attorney says, it's not the cost of the 3 phone calls. The $1 million is all the knowledge that went into knowing who to place those 3 phone calls to.
That's exactly it, right? And so I think
something along those lines.
Yeah, it's the cost. It has nothing to do with the time that I spent, right? And that's where I really want to push the generally accepted ways of pricing things in our field. You know, because when we think about it in terms of value, I think that gets us closer to, you know, actually receiving for us, you know, proper compensation.
Right.
And for, you know, our clients or our customers from paying what something is actually worth to them, right? When you buy a TV, you don't go in to Best Buy and say, okay, how much does this cost? And then the person working at Best Buy doesn't say, well, I don't know, how long are you going to watch it?
Right? Calculated that way.
Right. And I think that, you know, we as a profession would be a lot happier moving towards something where we base our pricing on value as opposed to time spent. Now, there's another business reason why the hourly billing model is pretty dumb. And it's this: I have 168 hours a week. There is a ceiling on how much money I can make based on the hourly billing model.
That might
not be reflective of the amount of value that I provide to clients. The only way you can scale an hourly model is to just bring more attorneys on.
Yeah. No. I had very early on in this podcast, I think it was episode 3, actually, had a woman on, her name was Pat Yevics. She ran the solo and small firm group in the Maryland Bar Association. And she had this advice on fixed price strategies. She said, keep raising your rates systematically every 6 months or every year, whatever it is. Keep raising your rates until you are losing more business than you're getting.
Yep.
And then you know you've priced it properly.
Well, that's right. You know, I have had this conversation with a number of attorneys where they're saying, I'm starting to not close on clients. And I said, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you're closing on everybody, it means you're not charging enough.
Right. And we've all had that experience. I've had that experience where I've quoted a price and I've done the work for the client. And in the course of doing the work for the client, I recognize that they're really getting a bargain here.
Sure. Sure.
And, you know, it's so you have to look at factor that in as well.
You know? Well, sure. Sure. You know, and one of the things that, you know, when I come across a potential customer who says, well, can't we do it the hourly rate? And I say, you know, I don't really do that, but let's think about it in terms of this. If we set up our relationship based on a billable hour model, all of the risk of the engagement goes to you, right? If it's more complicated than I thought that it was going to be, you are paying for it.
Right.
Right. I'm just going to bill you more hours. If on the other hand,
you start to see that light bulb starts to go off.
Right. You know, and that gives me really good reason to be careful about the scoping of my work. Right.
Now, will you get it right every time?
No. No. That's okay though.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, want to be on the right trajectory.
That's right. I mean, and typically what happens is, you know, if you get it wrong one time on the low end, you'll probably get it wrong another time on the high end. And it typically evens out if you're within the ballpark of what your services are actually valued for.
And you're paying attention to it.
Yeah.
So I want to move away from pricing for a moment. I wanted to talk about branding a little bit because like I told you in the pre-call, I think, you know, I'm somewhat, I feel like I'm interviewing myself to a degree because we are... approach to our firms aligns a lot. One of the things that I focus on very consciously is an effort to educate my clients and to speak to them in a way that isn't designed to, you know, impress them with how smart I am, but really to help them to understand the issues. And that, right. I noticed by looking at your website, that's very much a part of your brand about being, you know, the guy that you can talk to about legal issues in a way that you'll understand.
Right.
That was a conscious effort, obviously, on your part.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I was thinking about, you know, how to talk about my firm and myself, you know, I started immediately saying, okay, what makes me different and what makes me better? Because there are a lot of people who are really, really good at what you and I do, right? I mean, there's...
Yeah. Yeah.
But
and the vast majority of potential clients can't tell the difference.
That's right. You know, and so what are the things that make me different in a way that will appeal to potential customers, right? And some of it is, you know, I learned when I was in graduate school teaching that it didn't matter what I knew, right? It only mattered what I knew if I was able to impart that to my student. And so I learned very quickly that, you know, the jargon that I had learned needed to be thrown away pretty quickly because, you know, if I started talking about, you know, some weird post-structural theory, my student's eyes are just going to glaze over,
right?
They don't care. The same is true with what we do, right? I mean, I took 10 years of Latin, right?
Are a glutton for punishment.
I am a glutton for punishment, man. I have never used a Latin phrase with a client. Not once, right?
Right.
I speak in analogies, right?
Right.
You know, because it's important for all kinds of reasons that we've already discussed for our customers to understand what it is that we are doing for them and to help them make the decisions, right? I don't want to be the one making a decision for them. I'm an advisor. I'm not the decision maker. And if I'm not providing information to them in such a way that they understand what it is that they're facing, I'm not doing my job.
Right. Now, this is an area where I think, part of why I do this podcast, this is another area where I think law schools fail their students.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the writing and the language that we use in law school is designed to talk to other attorneys and to judges.
Right.
Okay? It's not designed to talk to clients. And if it is client focused, it's big client, corporate client focused.
That's
it's
right.
Not mom and pop. I didn't see one opportunity in law school on how to manage, you know, low income client
right.
through a divorce or through criminal defense work or anything.
Well, it's just not what we did. Well, right. And it's not the kind of model that the billable hour allows anybody other than public defenders to do, right?
Right. Exactly.
And law schools aren't going to get people to come to law school if they promise them public defender jobs. They're right. not going to take out the loans to get that kind of job.
Exactly.
You know,
even though some of the best attorneys I've known have been public defenders.
I have the highest yeah. amount of respect for
absolutely.
Public defenders. They've got the hardest job in our industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to move on because it's. I mean, clearly you've positioned your firm in that way about how you communicate with your clients. The other thing that's glaringly apparent from your website, and you know, also true on mine, is you spend a lot of time showing images of the staff members, mm-hmm. particularly the four-legged staff members.
That's right. As I noticed the same on yours.
Yeah, and I will tell you that when on my About Us page, when I included a photo of my wife and a photo of the dog, mm-hmm. and described myself first and foremost as a husband and a father.
Right. It became a lot easier to get clients, didn't it?
Clients came, started beating down the door. And literally, I posted that page to mm-hmm. the website, and the phone started ringing and hasn't stopped since.
That's right.
So
because
I really
she became
attribute,
a person.
I really attribute that to the success of the growth of our practice here. And I would assume the same is true with you. We heard a little bit in the background there, some of the office mates complaining
right.
about the work that you've assigned them. But have you noticed the same thing?
100%. The thing that I realized fairly early on, again, thinking about what makes me different and better, so many attorneys are afraid of being anything other than the suit, right? As though it were, you know, it's a costume that people wear, but it's yeah. not you. And you know, attorneys, we're used to being around other lawyers, right? We don't find each other scary, but normal people do find us scary, intimidating. Yep. You know, they don't look forward to talking with us. And if you can make yourself into just a normal person, which all of us actually are, despite our posturing.
Newsflash, right?
Right. You know, then people are going to relate to you and realize that you are a normal person and they can talk with you. And it does another thing, which is important. If you've done the work of identifying your ideal client profile, right? And if you haven't, please do.
Yeah.
When you are yourself and you put yourself out as yourself, your ideal clients will find you. And the ones who you don't want to work with will also find you and decide not to work with you. And that is every bit as good as your ideal clients finding you and working with you.
I will tell you that one of the screening questions we ask is, how did you learn about our law firm? Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of time people say, I just Googled it. Okay, right. When you Googled it, what did you do? Did you go to the website? Yeah, well, I went to the website, sure. I didn't just call you off the Google listing. I went
right.
and checked out your website. Oh. Anything resonate with you? Anything stand out? Well, hell yeah. I mean, the picture of your wife
right.
looking at the dog, that sold me because I'm a dog person.
That's it.
Okay. You know, and so now you know, having not done anything other than ask a couple of questions, that you have an ideal client right sitting in front of you.
That's right. They have self-selected into you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You know, and there are other things that you can do. You know, to ensure that you are working with the people that you want, because this is another thing that I'm doing differently with the second firm from what I did with the first is, you know, we're being much more careful about who we work with, because I learned the very hard way that one bad client is you know,
you're going to do a lot more damage to your psyche.
Like that's right. You know, I would rather give up five good clients than take one bad one.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I'm meeting with, for instance, the business clients, my startup clients, within the first two meetings, you know, I show up in a hoodie and a t-shirt. And what I find is if people are cool with that, we're going to be great. If they're not, we are a terrible fit, right?
Yeah, I've gone the same way, Owen. I'm now letting the clients know, hey, we're pretty casual around here.
Right. You know, when I meet with people on Zoom, I mean, the first thing that you notice, hey, tell me about those guitars that you have in the background.
Exactly.
I'm checking out
the background. I'm looking at all the books on your shelf. And
that's right. You know, for some people, it's the bust of Batman over my right shoulder. For some people, it's the guitar. Sometimes it's the books. But if that doesn't resonate with somebody, I already know that it's probably not going to be a great fit. And that's okay.
Yeah, to that point, when Owen and I had our pre-recorded call, we spent 20 minutes talking about the guitars, and because everybody knows I'm a guitar freak these days. Yeah. So that's what he's alluding to. Well, listen, Owen, I've kept you here long enough between the pre-call and the recording. This has been fabulous. Tell our audience where they can reach out to you if they want to follow up with anything you have to say. You already mentioned your LinkedIn profile. Is there any other good way for people to connect with you?
So LinkedIn, I am probably a little too active on LinkedIn, according to a lot of people, but you can find me there. You can find my business firm at McGrann Law, McGrannlaw.com. And probably starting in a week or two, the Purely Estates Law Group site will be up, and that's just purelyestates.com.
Well, we'll look forward to connecting on all those platforms, Owen. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to be a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Neil. It was great fun.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client, and then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.